what these things are.
Okay, thank you.
I feel like taking an eye off.
You want my clean copy to...
Oh, got it. Chris, did you email?
So this de-escalation grant, can't you speak to that? Because they teach all law enforcement to use de-escalation skills.
Yeah,
so
now,
why do
who
we
is
have
this?
To
going to call to order the Conference Committee on Senate File 671, the Judiciary and Public Safety Finance Omnibus Bill. Members, we do need to wrap this bill up today, and so we will be trading offers all day. The House goes into the back to the floor at 1:30. It's my anticipation that we'll go through the Senate offer now. The House will take a break. We will reconvene, make an offer, come back. We'll go through our offer. I understand you have some bills up on the Senate floor while we're not meeting, and it is my intention to keep making offers until we're ready to start voting provisions in or out. And, it's my intention we will wrap up this bill, and I assume that Senator Dibble and others may want to be at the event at 5, and so I would like this not to conflict with that.
All right, cool,
so if the Senate would like to walk through the offer.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair and members, I'll be working off the spreadsheet dated 5/14/2013, 10:16 a.m. And then we have it's titled Senate or Conference 4, and then it has an accompanying sheet, Senate Conference 4 Proposal - Money. We'll start there. The first change is line 15, Civil Legal Services. And once again, I've shaded them the way Mr. Walls did yesterday, the change items, so they're easier to see. The Senate position is to restore the $500,000 that was taken out in the last House proposal. The next item is line 27, Appeals Court Reimbursement. The Senate deleted the provision. Next line is line 37, Specialty Courts. The Senate accepted the House position, which was a slight cut. To the specialty courts. Lines 79 to 83, the Public Defense Board. The Senate position is we'd accept the House money and with the Senate allocation, with the provision that the extra $500,000 that the House proposed be put into line 80, caseload reduction, retention, and new hires. So it would be $500,000 above the Senate position with the Senate allocation, and that $500,000 being salted into new hires and retention.
So, Mr. Chair, if I might get clarification. Oh, yeah, sorry.
You're the chair.
All right. So so what does that bring the...
If you really insist.
Yeah, no, so what does that bring your total dollar amount to... on that line?
On that line?
For the
caseload reduction?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. It says $6,078,000.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Mr. Turner.
Okay. The next provision is in the Department of Public Safety, Homeland and Security Management. The Senate proposes cutting $500,000 from the Minnesota School Safety Center. The next line is... in Office of Justice Programs, line 150. The Community Offender Reentry Program is cut by $50,000 each year. So it's still in the bill, but it's at a total appropriation of $200 or $200,000. And then the next line, sex trafficking. The Senate proposals to cut $100,000, $50,000 each year from the trafficking training grants, so they'd be at $325,000 each year, and then the Senate also zeroes out the tails. Next line, 152, juvenile detention alternatives. The Senate put those back in the bill at $50,000 a year, and it's the same with the de-escalation grants on line 153, $50,000 each year.
Representative Paymer.
Did we ever find out if that community safety de-escalation grant is in another bill?
Sorry, I can't see your name tag. Miss.
Not on another Senate bill.
Yoakum.
Yoakum.
Yeah. I just, how do you pronounce it?
I'm sorry. Sorry, Chair.
Yoakum. Yoakum. Sorry.
Madam Chair, Senator Paymer, Chairman Paymer, it is not in another bill. It was originally in the state and local government bill, but they saw that the pot of money was supposed to be in public safety, so they moved it.
Representative Paymer?
That's good.
All right. Please continue, Mr. Turner.
Okay, the next issue.
Wait, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Chair.
Senator Lantz.
Want to point out on line 152, you'll note that while we reinstated funding for the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative, it's at half of our original rate.
Mr. Turner.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, the next item is on line 213, the Department of Corrections Health Services retention of MA inmate savings. And the Senate accepted the House position on lowering what the department was able to hang on to. The next line is line 274, Madam Chair, and that's the core technology fee, and that was deleted. And then the next line is judges' salaries. That's something that the committee is going to have to take up. Apparently, there was a if we're going to go at 3 and 3 for the judges pointed out to us last night that the second year is low in the proposal. And so it comes out to about $400,000 if we want to go to 3 and 3. So the committee can either find the money. I think everybody knows about that, right? And either find the money or we can appropriate what we have to the judges and just lower the percentage.
And Mr. Turner, what is the Senate's proposal in this offer?
Madam Chair, the Senate does not have a position on this at this time.
Madam Chair?
Senator Lantz.
We were just made aware of this morning when we came in, and we figured it's something that we ought to talk about as a conference committee. We didn't have any particular solution to that at this time.
Okay. Mr. Turner, please continue.
Okay, Madam Chair, just on to the other some other issues. I talked about the tax court judges' salaries yesterday. I'll be getting the final tax court numbers today. That's a matter of a couple $1,000s, but we want to get it right. I'll keep my eye on that. The next issue is the Min Court transfer. Right now it's in at the House, or it's in at, the transfer's in at $1,300,000 each year. The appropriation is in at $1,500,000. And we've got to decide, the committee has to decide whether you want to go CD beds or sex offender beds or half a beach.
Good call.
And Mr. Turner, does the Senate have a position on what that should be at this point? Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, on these other issues, I don't think, other than the youth intervention program allocation language, I think these are more issues than our Senate positions.
Senator Lantz.
My understanding is that it was the Senate's intention to propose to whatever number we choose to allocate or transfer out of MinCorps, that it simply be divided 50-50 between additional CD beds and additional sex offender beds, unless we wanted to get some more information from the agencies as to, you know, where there's a more acute shortage, or where the rate of return, if you will, is stronger, which we could certainly do to get us more information on that. But absent that, I think it's the easiest thing is just to split it 50-50. There's certainly a shortage for both types of treatment beds.
Madam Chair.
Representative Paymer.
To that, except I think we do need to hear from the Department of Corrections, because I understand that they, at least on the sex offender treatment, that they have these pods, and you know, there's a certain amount of offenders to fill a pod, or however long that treatment goes. So I don't know if you can do a half a pod. So I think we need more information if it's possible to split the amount. There's a need on the side, obviously. I just just think the conference committee should be aware that of the sex offenders that are in the Department of Corrections right now, only 30% of them are getting any treatment at all. I suspect that the substance abuse numbers are also dismal, but and I'm not sure one is a priority over the other, except I think
both bad.
I have major concerns that sex offenders are getting released without any treatment.
Is there someone here from the department that would like to talk about those issues? So please come to the table. Welcome to the committee. Commissioner Roy, please go ahead.
Morning, Madam Chair, committee members, Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections. Regarding the question of chemical dependency treatment or sex offender treatment, our need is so great in both areas that I am really challenged to tell you which is more important. Certainly our sex offender clients have a lower rate of recidivism generally, but they have extremely high stakes. That means if a sex offender reoffends, it is a big deal, and we are certainly concerned about that. But the numbers of offenders with chemical dependency issues are very great in our system, estimated between 80 and 90%. So we have great need, limited resources, and if I was really proposing a wish list this morning, it would be that you triple or quadruple all of our funding for treatment of these two offender groups. But I am a realist, and I know that probably is not going to happen. So whatever designation you folks make, we will do our best with those funds, and we can certainly enhance both areas of treatment.
Madam Chair.
Represent Paymar.
Commissioner, I had Assistant Commissioner Laura. What's it we had in our office? I'm not sure who's Carlson. Assistant Commissioner Carlson in my office, and we went through this at some length, and that's where I understand that there's this issue around pods. And so if we're obviously we'd like to give you more money too and can't, but we have this pot of money that we can use, and I don't want it I want it to be effective. So if there is like a pod,
Commissioner Roy.
Well, she's conferring with him. If giving half of the money isn't workable, then I think that's a discussion we should have. And I'm not hearing that from you,
Commissioner Roy.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, we can split this money. I think that's your question. We would propose a 50-bed CD enhancement and a 50-bed sex offender enhancement. And again, we are committed to using best practices and best treatment methods, and hopefully we can, and I know we can demonstrate good outcomes. So I think you should be confident, and the committee should be confident, that this money will be well used and we will prevent future crime. That is our mission.
Representative Paymar?
No, that's fine, as long as it's doable, because I understood that there was a question about the numbers that could be treated, that this pod perimeter that you have, and I don't understand how that whole thing works. And so if you're saying that 50% will provide 50 beds for sex offenders, then that's...
Commissioner Roy.
Madam Chair, Representative, the number of beds, of course, is dependent upon your final decision about the allocation, and we are hopeful that what is being proposed here, we can do that.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Commissioner Roy, is there an issue with where the space of these treatment beds or the facilities by which they're in, or is there an issue with that at all? Commissioner Roy?
Madam Chair, we are at the cusp of full capacity in our facilities, and we are actually boarding out some offenders, and space is always an issue for us, but we will make it work. And I can't tell you this morning what facility or what expansion areas we would accomplish, but we'll make it work.
So, Commissioner Roy, if we allocated the money and said that it had to be spent on treatment beds for sex offenders and for CD treatment, would you be able to best figure out how to allocate those resources somewhat equally, or do we need to be very prescriptive in that you shall spend 50-50, or Commissioner Roy?
Madam Chair, I'm sure my clinicians that are probably watching this testimony are scratching their head right now and hoping that I make the right answer here. The clinicians and our treatment staff certainly would be better able to address the curriculum and the treatment methodologies that will best utilize this allocation. So I'm requesting that you not be too prescriptive in terms of exact numbers of beds. I will gladly report back to the committee as soon as possible the description of that. But again, I hope you have some confidence that we have been in this business for quite a while, and we will we have models of treatment that we believe are do the job. So we will expand. And you've heard me say from the moment I've been in this chair that we have a huge need, and anything is going to be a positive effect on what we do.
Thank you, Commissioner Roy. Other questions from members? All right. Seeing none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Lyons.
I'll just state for the record that I like the chair's suggestion relating to not being too prescriptive and having confidence that the department will allocate it roughly 50-50, but have some flexibility to meet their specific needs.
Thank you. Mr. Turner, please continue with the offer.
Madam Chair, members. The next issue on my list is the Medicaid County Share Rider. We spoke about yesterday that's in the Department of Human Services bill, I guess. And I spoke with our Senate Counsel for Human Services and got a look at the rider that's in, and I don't recognize a cap that you spoke about. So I was hoping that you guys could track that down. And then secondly, I guess we could talk about how that's going to work. I understand where Corrections thinks that they're in a dangerous position if county expenses go through the roof. But if it's capped, if Corrections is capped, who would pay that? Then would it revert back to the county, or would DHS have to pay?
Mr. Walls?
Madam Chair, members, the way that these forecasted programs work, if there were an overage in the cost of the coverage that were paid on these inmates, the state would pay the cost. However, if the Department of Corrections had to bear that cost, it would come out of their budget, and we would not be providing additional money. If it increases over what has been forecasted in the fiscal note by the Department of Human Services, they would automatically have that built into their budget in the November forecast. So my understanding is DHS bears no risk. The state would assume that cost, but DHS bears no risk because the forecast protects them. What the cap protects is the Department of Corrections budget.
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair and members, the next item is the Youth Intervention Program allocation language. It's the Senate position that the language in carried by Senator Dibble, is the preferred language. And then finally,
Madam Chair,
Senator Lacks.
To that point, you recall, I see Representative Paymar has that language in front of him. If I'm looking correctly, this is the language that I handed to you last night when your side went to consider the matter. And I don't know if you got a chance to look at it, or Representative Paymar has. But that's what we're referring to, I believe.
Mr. Chair, maybe
Senator,
Representative
Paymar.
Maybe Senator Dibble or Mr. Beattie could, we could ask him to explain this in more detail. It seems like a dramatic jump to me to fund the expenses. I have said publicly when we passed our bill out that I certainly support the expansion of the YIP program so we can start more of them up in greater Minnesota. But this would give them 5% of the total grant allocation, if I understand it correctly. And then they would not be required to get a local match to meet the obligation under this language. So this is a break in the way they've been doing things, as I understand it, and I'm not convinced that the 5% is the number we should land on. I think we increased it to 2% in our bill. You still have it at 5%, but I'm up to listening to what your arguments are.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, well, Mr. Beattie is at the table, so he can speak to it more eloquently than I can, but with what they have in mind. But it is a jump, but it also represents a significant increase in the kinds and the quality of services they intend to provide to all the community-based organizations, so that, you know, if we are able to gain back some of the dollars that they've lost over the years and hopefully at some point along the way actually gain some ground in what is, I think everyone agrees, very cost-effective services, these diversion intervention services. YIPA has in mind providing quite a bit of additional capacity as the support organization for the network community-based organizations. I think moving up to the 5%, now that we've scaled back even the dollars, because, you know, they need the resources, the staff resources and the like, is probably even more important. But why don't I refer to Mr. Beattie?
Mr. Beattie, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. The reason the 5% increase is really comes from the grantees, and it's been something they've really wanted to do for many years. And really what would happen with this, the money, the additional money for YIPA, would be that because we provide the training and technical assistance to these grantees, and the whole idea with this is to help pay for a staff person, our training staff person, and provide all that training for free to the grantees. See, right now they pay for that training out of their grant money, so this would just take that cost away from them. In addition, there's we really, especially if we're getting some additional funding here for new programs throughout the state, we really feel that it's important that those grantees work with us and work with the other grantees, so there's a lot of collaboration and program sharing around that. And the big part, too, is the outcome. We really believe that if this happens, we really have to measure outcomes very well so we can show the legislature and this committee how these programs are doing. And we really want to be able to measure those outcomes and continue to measure those outcomes in a really effective way. And the reality is that the last 3 years, the Office of Justice programs have been doing an outcome research on that program, but that was through federal dollars, and that money is drying up, so we really feel like we need to get involved and have more staff time and more time with that to measure the outcomes for these grantees. So it's really kind of threefold, I think. we will be offering more trainings in a lot of different ways. We'll be working with those grantees in Greater Minnesota and other specific culturally specific organizations that we really feel need this additional funding. So we're going to offer the trainings for free, and they would be able to save those dollars and put it right into programs. So in a lot of ways, it may be coming, some of that might be coming to us, and it's a jump, but it's really helping them out. And like I said, it's a grantee initiative that they brought to us.
Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
So how much are we actually talking about?
If the dollar amount stood as it is right now, it'd be $125,000 at 5% a year.
And, Madam Chair, where would the money go?
Well, it would pay for, Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, it would pay for a staff person, and it would pay for the trainings. Our training budget is probably about $200,000 a year. That's what YIPA actually puts out, and we get that money. It was the 1% that we were getting, and we get the other money from grantees or from grants and contributions. So we're really trying to stabilize that whole providing training to the grantees.
Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, so this is an existing staff person, or you're going to hire another staff person?
Existing staff person that we just hired about a year ago.
So,
Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, so is this increasing this person's salary?
Nope. It's not increasing the person's salary. It's really trying to pay for part of that person's salary and also pay for the trainings. We, like I said before, the 1% that we've been getting was $15,000 a year, and that it just wasn't enough for us to provide trainings and do all the things that we were trying to do and all the things that these grantees are asking of us, and we just can't do it. And it's so important for them to have well-trained staff. And as you may know, that an agency is only as good as its least trained staff, and that's really our goal, is to make sure that these organizations have very well trained staff, because it's the bottom line. If they're not well trained, they're not going to pick up on these issues that these kids have, and the big thing is that they pick up on that stuff and make sure they're either dealing with them or making the proper referral.
Madam Chair, so the $125,000 will go to augment the staff member's salary, or to use a portion of it. So this, I still seems like, if you're giving them a raise, for her a raise, to do more training, I guess that's fine. So then, and then the rest of the money is to pay for the trainings, so that the organizations don't have to pay for the trainings. Is that correct?
Mr. Beattie.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, that is correct.
Madam Chair, Paymar. Do you know of any other organization? I'm just trying to get any other organization. I'm trying to, this model that you have here, it just seems like I've never seen this before. Where you have sort of a consortium of organizations, and why wouldn't you're sort of at the center of this, providing their training. I'm just trying to look. I just don't know of another model like that.
Mr. Beattie. Senator Dibble.
Well, if Mr. Beattie knows, that would be great, but I think it's the Centers for Independent Living, Center Justice Coalition, and there's a number of organizations where the community-based organizations come together in a consortium. There's an umbrella organization that provides a kind of a more efficient model, some of this capacity, support, training. I've seen it quite a bit myself. And Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, I don't know why. This wouldn't change the line item. This is a proposal that's coming forward from YIPA, as the organization as well as all the supporting organizations. I don't know why we would think that this is a bad idea. It's their initiative.
Madam Chair, I'm just trying to make sure that the money, whatever state money we're putting into this thing, that it's being used in an accountable manner. And that's the purpose of the line of questioning. And I'm also concerned that, you know, when organizations become that insular and don't have opportunities for other kinds of trainings except within their within one entity, they're missing out on, I believe, on some other cutting-edge approaches. And I'm not sure if that exists or not, but I guess I could have that conversation with Mr. Beatty before we close this up.
Senator Dibble.
Those are great questions. Maybe Mr. Beatty can respond to them right now.
Mr. Beatty.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think our training is cutting edge. I can just tell you a couple things that we've done over the last few years and what we continue to do. We provide trainings last year to over 1,500 youth service providers through this network. The other thing that we do is we are now, because we know it's so important, it's very cost prohibitive, especially for organizations in greater Minnesota, to come to a training in the city. So we provide trainings all over the state. We provide them in Duluth. We provide them in Brainerd. We provide them in Moorhead, Rochester, southern Minnesota, and the Twin Cities. And we're also doing online trainings and a lot of courses to really make it easier for these organizations and these staff people to attend these kind of trainings. So they're not spending additional dollars driving to the cities or taking time off. We're trying to make it as available to them as possible.
Representative Paymer?
Maybe I can talk with Mr. Beatty later about that. But I just, so is any of this money going to your salary, or is it going just to the YIP programs?
Mr. Beatty.
Well, it goes partly to the salary for the training coordinator, and I suppose there would be maybe a little bit of supervisory time that we would put into that. But really what we're going to be doing, and you have to understand the staff time that it would take, not just for the trainings but also for the outcome measurement and the outcome stuff that we're going to be doing, in addition to the whole thing of bringing these folks together and providing this resource for them as an umbrella organization. People may not understand this, but organizations that, especially out in greater Minnesota, I mean, they come to our meetings, our quarterly meetings, because it's so important for them to connect to other youth intervention programs. And they learn from that, and they talk to people, and they network. And those are the kind of things. And we can't do that for free either. So, but the majority of this money is really going to go towards providing free training to these grantees.
Well, Madam Chair, then two things, and then I'll stop. One is, what would be the question is, now you're exempt from getting a match. Is that correct?
Mr. Beatty.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, the reason we put the exempt from the match in there is because most of the matching dollars that we've used in the past have been through the training dollars that they've paid. If we're providing free training, we can't come up with the match. You know what I mean? The match wouldn't be there. We could use some match. We could use some of our foundation dollars and some of our contributions for the match, but it wouldn't be enough. So, and because we're so different than the community-based agencies, the whole idea with the match is designed to leverage community dollars, because each one of these youth intervention programs are, the idea is that for every dollar they get from the state up to that $50,000 level, which nobody gets at this point because there's never been enough money, but what would happen is they have to then go to their community and get $2 for every dollar they get from the state. So it really leverages, and that's the whole idea behind the community-based matching dollars. And we're just a little different because we're not providing direct services like that. So the only place that, I mean, our direct services is to the organizations and to the youth service professionals.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. We don't have to belabor it at this point, but I would just encourage Mr. Beatty in this conversation that you have to talk about some of the transparency and accountability measures that are a part of this proposal.
You bet. We, you know,
Mr. Beatty.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, Representative Paymar, you know, we get this money. If we get the money from the Office of Justice Programs, we have to report to them just like any other grantee. And, you know, they keep track of it, and they do a great job of that. So I think there would be transparency there, and, you know, they would be reporting on that. And if the part that I think is important to know, too, is in the language of the bill, it says may take up to 5%. It doesn't take, because our original bill asked for a significantly more than what's been offered at this point. And so we need to look back. We'll see what, you know, how much we're going to need. It may not be the full 5%. If we're not adding, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 programs like we hoped we would do throughout the state, we may not need to take the full 5%, but we'll work on that. We'll work with Office of Justice Programs to make sure that it's fair. So.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Beatty.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Turner, if you'd continue with the Senator offer. Senator Dietzek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to, I went to the YIPA website, and so they do have some good information on there, and it does appear to, I mean, they've got their, some of their partners and some of their allied members are Blue Earth County, Olmsted County, they got the Moorhead Police, and so it is a broad, it appears to be a broad base of organizations from community corrections departments to the police department to Boys and Girls Clubs throughout the state that are, and it lists all of their training programs, and some of the stuff is, you know, a variety of topics on, you know, dealing with kids in poverty to, you know, Dr. Seuss to porn and how to deal with kids, and so it does. You know, I didn't know much about it, but I, you know, even just while we were sitting here, they do have a broad-based stuff, and it looks like they just deal with teachers and other organizations that deal with kids that, you know, hopefully to, like it says, intervene. So I think it's worth it. Thank you.
Thank you. Great. Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair and members, there's one item left on my list, and it's more of a, something for me to remember. When Senator Latz presents his data gathering provisions later today, the Supreme Court took a look at them and suggested an effective date change. And so I think Senator Latz is aware of that and can bring that up at time.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
Can I, just what's our plan for the skit? Because I said to Senator Latz that I would like him to walk through all of that and also to update us on the fiscal note and all of those gun provisions. And I don't know when we'll have time to do that.
Well, Representative Watts, the first thing we want to do is hear what the entire offer is, and I assume that the gun provisions are going to be part of the offer. So when we get to them, I would assume that you will talk about what it is that you're asking of us as part of your offer.
That's right. Although, Madam Chair, we're calling them the data gathering provisions, so a more neutral term.
All right. So I assume that when you present your data gathering proposal, that you will be presenting it so that we know what language we're looking at and what we're talking about, so we have a clear understanding of what your offer is.
Absolutely.
Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
And so does this effective date change in getting this information to NICS? Does this change the fiscal note at all?
Senator Latz. Mr. Turner.
No.
Madam Chair, members, no, it does not.
All right. Mr. Backus.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I will very quickly go through this document entitled Senate Second Offer Non-Rider Items. And just to clarify, in the Senate's mind, at least, this takes care of the rest of the non-rider provisions. It's shorter than the versions we've seen in the last two offers because essentially anything that we've agreed to has now been taken off the list. So this is only items that are still unresolved.
Mr. Backus, I just think that each and every time we make a different offer, things change on what's offered. And so we may want to keep the provisions on the list going forward just so that things don't fall off inadvertently. Mr. Backus.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Chair Hillstrom. And Mr. Turner already discussed some of these, so I'll try to go through them very briefly. The first two cells are the House, the Court Technology Fee and the Court of Appeals Judge Reimbursements. As Mr. Turner mentioned, the Senate offer is the Senate position. The next provision is the House-only provision on mandatory sentences for repeat sex offenders. The Senate has this language, but it's in the Finance Committee. The Senate offer here is to hear basically more information about the House position. The House amended this bill in committee, and it's never been discussed in conference committee, so I think the Senate would like more information at some point. The next provision is the DOC-DHS interagency agreement. As Mr. Turner mentioned, we've had some preliminary discussions with our HHS staff, and it's basically I think we just need to determine more about that House cap and I guess maybe get more information or discuss it further.
Does staff have that, Mr. Diebel or Ms. Perius? I mean, if it's something that we can take care of quickly, we should just do that, and if we can't, we can come back to it.
John has it.
Oh, John. Okay. So Mr. Walls has it, so we'll come back to that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And continuing then, the next issue we've already discussed about, that's that youth intervention program that we've just discussed. So that would be the Senate offer is the Senate position. The next issue is the data gathering provisions, as Senator Latz mentioned. It's the at some point, I think we'll be handing out the language. The only change to that language, or the only thing, is what Mr. Turner mentioned about that date. Give the courts a little more time to provide some of that information so that they can do it within the boundaries of our current money for it. And then the final provision is a Senate provision that would ask the House to take the forensic lab accreditation piece, which has been negotiated in the Omnibus Data Practices Bill, and we can get you language on that later. And if I could just say one more thing, this offer sheet does not mention the fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct, the felony provision. I think the Senate's interpretation, there was an email from MnCASA yesterday seeming to take that off the table, so it's not listed here, but the Senate position would be to not do that then.
So, Senator Latz, I assume that you want to give us more detail on the other pieces of your offer. So whether you want to start, whichever piece you want to start with, you have two significant policy pieces that are new that this committee has not heard anything about, and we haven't seen any language yet. So which would you like to take first, Senator Latz?
I'd be delighted to take the data gathering provision first. As the chair knows, the issues are not new to the conversations. But they are new to the formal presentation before the conference committee. So,
do you have language, Senator Lance?
I do, Madam Chair.
We could pass that out to the committee. I'd like a copy. Do the chairs. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The language that you have in front of you, the CE3 document, was amended this morning in the Senate Finance Committee and passed out of the committee on a vote of 15-2. So this is the language I'm proposing. I'll put it in context for you and explain what my goal is here. As I know everyone in this room knows, there have been a lot of discussion this legislative session about attempts to reduce gun violence. Those attempts involved quite a few different pieces And there was quite a bit of inability to resolve any kind of a final package on that. However, it seemed to me that there was at least one piece of all the moving parts that there was broad consensus on that ought to be done. And it does not in any way expand the categories of data gathering. It doesn't expand the range or scope of background checks, which I know was one of the flashpoints. It does not apply to any more transactions, private sales, sales through commercial entities, or anything like that. What it does is it fills in the gaps in the existing databases that are used to screen existing applications for permits to purchase or carry and to authorize the sales transactions, essentially the ones that go through the federally licensed dealers. So the database and federal law contemplates and mandates that the state provide information to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. However, the state has not had the data aggregated in such a way that it could provide that information to NICS. The language that we have before us now is an attempt basically to thread the political needle on this issue and pass into law and fund the project to gather the data and fill in the gaps in this database system. The CE3 that you have in front of you basically contains, several parts. First, I'm going to tell you what's not in there. Although you see it on paper in front of you, you'll see there's an X through it, and that's on page 5, section 8. And the reason that is still there is because it was part of the original committee engrossment in the Senate Finance side that was awaiting action and, in fact, was acted upon this morning. It contained one piece of what has become referred to as the prosecutor's package. That was the piece that expanded the definition of crime of violence to include some additional felony crimes of violence. Based upon my conversations with quite a variety of people in the last so many days now, I could not achieve consensus that piece, either alone or in combination with anything else, could be included in this effort. So I'm not trying to reignite any debates. I'm not trying to forge new areas of consensus. I'm not trying to make amendments that'll make one group happy or another group happy. I'm simply trying to find the pieces that already exist that we can pass. And so this morning, Finance Committee deleted Section 8. So all that's left now are the data gathering provisions. They have two main components. One has to do with gathering the civil commitment data, and the other has to do with, gathering the data from pretrial diversion programs and certain gross misdemeanors that already disqualify persons from possessing firearms but aren't, for some reason, aggregated into the right database mechanisms to be accessible for the screening process. So now, with regard to the civil commitment information, currently the records that are maintained in the right format are from the year 2008 to the present. But from 1994 to 2008, those records are not maintained in an appropriate format for this. Many of the records are still in paper files that are maintained off-site. And what I am told is that at some point in the past, this information was transferred to the Department of Human Services with the expectations that they would report it to NICS. But that NICS would not accept it because they weren't the agency that originally created the data. So it kind of languished, and no one really paid close attention to making sure that it, what was supposed to have been done was done. So as we were preparing for this session, it was determined that we needed to pull that information back up, and actually it was Hennepin County Sheriff Stanek that caught a good portion of this. That data needs to be found, entered into a computer system, formatted so it can go to the BCA, and then reported to NICS.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mark.
Could you just explain that a little bit, go a little bit deeper, just so I understand? So you're saying that from 1994 to 2010, the courts were not providing the BCA with fingerprints of civilly committed individuals?
Senator Lantz.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymore, I'm going to refer you first of all to the page 8 of the document you have in front of you, section 11, that addresses the prior civil commitments and felony convictions. And I'm going to note for one thing that the dates I referred you to were a little bit off compared to, I think, what's on the fiscal line. So maybe the courts can help me clarify the dates that are in that provision. But it's my understanding that Senator Paymar is correct, that the information on the persons that were civilly committed had not been entered into the electronic NICS system, and that there was also some felony conviction data in some of these date ranges that also were not entered.
Ms.
Marshall maybe can flesh some of
that. That would be in Section B there, the 2008 to 2012, that somehow these felonious crimes or these individuals convicted of felonies were not appropriately matched into the into the BCA database.
Senator Lantz.
That's the premise upon which I am working, and I understand to be the case. But Ms. Marshall may have more information on that. Well, I'm actually curious why line 8 says 2010 instead of 2008, which had been my understanding before.
Welcome to the committee. Ms. Marshall, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Janet Marshall with the State Court Administrator's Office. And I must say I am not familiar with the Section B, the part that is about that we have identified as needing funding is the Section A, and that is the civil commitment records going back to 1994. They are in paper format until sometime probably 2007, 2008, and then in 2010 we started electronically transmitting that to NICS. So we would go back and have to find all these paper files.
Senator Lantz.
Okay. Madam Chair, there are about
Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I was talking to Mr. Diebel. I apologize.
Okay. Senator Lantz.
Madam Chair, there are about 67,000 civil commitment files that need this attention. So it's a lot of work. But if we get that data together and it becomes part of the BCA system and the NICS system, I think it can have substantial impact on at least efforts to keep guns out of the hands of persons that have a court-adjudicated history of mental illness or chemical dependency and commitment for us.
Representative Paymar.
So I just want to be clear. So, I mean, because so Senator Lantz and Ms. Marshall, so as I was trying to figure out how the fiscal note, too, and how you came up with these dollars, which is significant. So who is going to do what, and how is it going to get done?
Ms. Marshall.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, what we are hoping, depending on how much time we have to do it, we would have to hire temporary workers to go out to the court locations and look through the files, and then we'll have to put them into our case management system.
Representative Paymar.
So, Ms. Marshall, so you would go to each courthouse? I mean, how would you logistically do this? You'd go to each courthouse and somehow do a query into who was civilly committed or who was convicted of a felony from the years 2008 to 2012, and then manually take those files somehow and have them processed electronically at the BCA, who would then forward those to NICS. Is that accurate?
Ms. Marshall.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, in terms of the felony convictions, we would not have to go and physically look at files. We can run queries on our case management system.
Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
But then the civilly committed individuals from 94 to 2010, you would go to every courthouse in the state?
Ms. Marshall.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, we have not completed the logistics of this. In some of the courthouses, perhaps the existing staff will be able to help us look through the files. But we figured, I think we calculated it would be like 10 minutes to look at each file. And when you have 67,000 to look at, that's a lot of hours.
Representative Paymar.
And Ms. Marshall, how do we know that there's 67 files? 67,000 files.
Ms. Marshall.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, we have approximately 4,000 civil commitments processed each year, and we need to go back 16.75 years.
Representative Paymar.
Okay, so and where would we find this in the fiscal note? Are you going to?
Ms. Marshall.
Chair Hellstrom, Representative Paymar, on page 9 of the fiscal note.
Representative Paymar.
I'm waiting for. I've got page 9. I'm waiting for it to come. Ms. Marshall, where on page 9? So you're. Is that the third paragraph? It's assumed the section that require one time data cleanup?
Yes. And.
Representative Paymar.
Representative Paymar, if you also go on to page 10 under the expenditures and the second and the third and the fourth paragraphs talk about the minutes per file that we assume we will have to take.
Representative Paymar.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm just sorry for getting into the weeds here on what they're actually going to do, but I'm just trying to, I just want to understand. So will the court hire people to do this, or will you be able to contact the courts and have them do this work?
Representative Paymar, no, we will have to, I think it'll be a combination of having to hire people for the larger locations and hoping that we can rely on staff on the small counties that wouldn't have many cases to begin with.
Representative Paymar.
So is that, I don't see that in the fiscal notes. So is it the FTEs that you're going to hire? Is that
Representative?
Is that the $1 million dollar figure that I see at the bottom of page 10?
Ms. Marshall.
Representative Paymar, it's actually the Section 11, $800,400. We figured, depending on how much time they give us, if we're given a year to accomplish this, it'll take 12 people 1 year. If we're given 2 years to do it, it'll take 6 people 2 years, and it comes out to about the same dollar amount.
Representative Paymar.
Very good. Thank you.
So, Ms. Marshall, there's been some discussion that this data exists already out at the DHS. In that when local law enforcement actually does their background checks, that they actually consult the DHS database. Is there any usefulness with the courts in that DHS database that currently exists that NICS just wouldn't accept, or are you just assuming that you have to go back to all original queries and all original files and don't have the ability to use the system that currently law enforcement uses for permit to carry and permit to purchase? Ms. Marshall.
Representative Paymar, Representative Hillstrom, we're hoping that we can work with DHS. The The one piece of information that is not in the DHS system is when someone is what is commonly called co-committed. They're committed to the Commissioner of Human Services and to a private facility. DHS only collects commitments just to the Commissioner of Human Services.
Thank you. Senator Lance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that's essentially the data gathering for the civil commitments. Also in here is the provision to aggregate the data for certain gross misdemeanors that are already make a person ineligible to possess a firearm, and pretrial diversion program information or programs that are utilized when a crime of violence that is a prohibited one enters the court system. And that's on page 7, members, in section 10. So that is the what is being referred to in the spreadsheet as the court's data integration project. Then the rest of the bill basically contains the mandates to put things in electronic format, make sure they're searchable, setting deadlines, either 24 hours or 3 business days or so on, to make sure that happens so data, when received, is promptly entered into the system and reported to NICS, and then the mandate to make sure that they report it, in fact, to NICS. So that's essentially the proposal here.
Representative Paymar.
One other question I had, Senator Lance, is there's on page 8, there's this section 12 reference to, if you could explain what you're asking the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Policy Group to do. And then a sort of a corollary to that is, are there any data privacy issues that might come up regarding anything in this provision?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Policy Group is directed to basically report on the search capabilities of the BCA system and recommended how they may be improved. It certainly will complement the criminal history and reporting system information that are being funded in other places of this conference committee's report. There's a lot of information within the criminal justice system databases that I think it's not clear exactly what the status is. Be important for all of us for informational purposes to have that so we can make future decisions on a well-informed basis.
Representative Paymar.
The other part of that question was whether there is anything that the conference committee should know, since this is all relatively new language to some people here. Are there any concerns that might get raised around data privacy issues?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, that question hasn't come up to me before, but the data, wherever it goes, retains its classification wherever it travels to. So at least within the state system, it would, and my understanding is that once it's sent to NICS, it's got its own restrictive uses there. But any data that is aggregated or gathered in this process would retain its current data classification.
Representative Paymar, I think that the data that is contemplated in this bill is actually already data that is supposed to be going or was supposed to have already gone to the NICS system. And so this isn't new data going in. This isn't a new type of information. This is data that was supposed to have gotten into the system, however, never did, either because DHS's data was not accepted by NICS or because the law had not yet been passed ordering that the data go to NICS, which is why the paper file is here. So this isn't any new types of data, and so I don't think there should be new data practices issues. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Latz.
under statute 624.713, subdivision 4, a person who is civilly committed has the right to petition a court and ask that their right to use firearms be restored should they meet a certain amount of conditions. And I'm sure that some of those 67,000 Minnesotans have petitioned the court and had their right to use firearms restored. How would that be handled under your Section 11 when we're doing this data transfer of people who have been civilly committed? How will we reflect the fact that some of those people have had their right to use firearms restored?
Senator Lance.
Madam Chair, Representative Moline, first of all, let me say that there is nothing in this proposal that changes anything with regard to the eligibility or the process for someone to petition the court for restoration of those rights. As to the detail of how the court plans to account for that, those instances, I think we'd have to ask Ms. Marshall.
Okay. Ms. Marshall.
Chair Hillstrom, Representative Meelan, that will go into part of our consideration when we map out how we're going to accomplish this. We know we will have to. We're going to have to check the names. We're going to have to see if their civil rights have been restored. And that'll be another one of the tasks that these little temporary workers are going to have to accomplish.
Representative Moline.
Madam Chair and Ms. Marshall, do you have any idea how many of those people between 1994 and 2010 have had their right to use firearms restored?
Ms. Marshall.
Representative Hillstrom, Representative Meelan, no, I do not.
Representative Moline.
Madam Chair and Ms. Marshall, I mean, I guess the same would go true then for those convicted of a felony, because under statute 609.165, a person who's convicted of a crime of violence as either a juvenile or an adult also has the right to petition a court and have their right to use firearms restored. And it seems like we'd also have to make sure under those circumstances that the data is properly transferred and people who have had their constitutional right to use firearms restored have that data reflected properly in the transfer of data. I guess I have a lot of concerns that that will fall through the cracks. I've represented people before who have petitioned the court and had their right to use firearms restored, and we've been successful in those efforts. But if we're now going back and collecting data on 67,000 Minnesotans who were civilly committed but may have their rights restored, I'm worried that there's not proper protection in, you know, your language or the method that we're approaching that would make sure that that's properly reflected in the data transfer. And if people have had their right to use firearms restored, we want to make sure that there's no infringement on those rights.
Senator Lutz.
Madam Chair, I agree with you. The courts should devise a map out a plan that makes sure that they capture that data and include it.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Marshall, what would impact the fiscal note more? And, of course, keeping in mind the plain language of the proposed bill, would it be less expensive for you to, when going through and finding out everyone who's been excluded, redacting those names from your report for people who have had their rights restored? Or would it be less expensive to add an addendum and say, oh, by the way, these people have also had their rights restored? And would it be your opinion that you would have to do the latter because the plain language, not just of this bill, but also of existing law, says you have to transmit?
Ms. Marshall.
Representative Hillstrom, Representative Lesh, we really hadn't thought about that, but I think we would probably have to do the latter, because it has to be an accurate record. And I don't know that redacting a name would accurately reflect what that record is all about. You have to put both of them in there.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, if I can, my question is, what else is this particular information with respect to civil commitments used for? Because, for example, if I am prohibited from possessing a firearm because of my civil commitment, and that information is transmitted to Nick's. Why else would Nick's be accessed for that data other than to check about my eligibility for a firearm? Are there other reasons? And if there is no other reason, I can imagine that I wouldn't want my name being transmitted in the first place, because what's the point?
Ms. Marshall.
Representative Hilston, Representative Lesh, I am not personally familiar with NICS, so I do not know what NICS uses the data for.
Okay.
I just know we do have the requirement and have since 2010 transmitted civil commitments to the BCA, which goes to NICS.
Well, Madam Chair, I would ask if there's anyone else in the room who can answer what else we use NICS for with respect to civil commitments other than firearms. There may be some information, if there is, I'd like to know, but in light of everything that we talk about, Madam Chair, with respect to collateral consequences, I would think that we would want to reduce collateral consequences for individuals rather than increase. And most assuredly, if we transmitted ineligibility for civil commitment, whether or not we then subsequently transmitted a restoration of civil rights would be small consolation, because these individuals would still have hurdles, regardless of whether it said, oh, by the way, you were later found to be eligible. That's all, Madam Chair. If there's anyone else who could answer that, it would be handy.
Anyone here in the audience an expert on this database system? All right. Come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Dana Goetz. I'm with MNJIS at the BCA. And it's our understanding that NICS is only used for the firearms checks, but we can definitely double-check that and get back to the committee shortly.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Malian.
Go ahead, Representative.
Well, I just wanted some clarification on that, too. The 67,000 files, then, these would go to the BCA. Would the BCA then determine which of the 67,000 would get sent to NICS? Because it would seem to, I mean, you would not, why would you send a file to NICS unless someone was purchasing a pistol or a firearm? I mean, that would be the only criteria you'd send it. So if someone was civilly committed for something and did not buy a firearm, it seems to me that information would stay at the BCA solely.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Goetz. Is it Goetz?
Yes.
Ms. Goetz.
Representative Paymer. Actually, all the civil commitments are automatically passed from BCA to NICS.
Hey, Madam Chair, is that a federal law? Or where does that come from?
Ms. Goetz.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymer, I believe that is part of the NICS federal law.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so Representative Moline, then Representative Cornish. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I'm just wondering currently, maybe Ms. Marshall has to come forward again, though, but if since 2010 you've been transferring all the civil commitments to NICS, what do you do with people who have had their right to use firearms restored since 2010? Do you then send that information to NICS so that they have notice that the person can use firearms?
Ms. Marshall.
Representative Paymer, Representative, I don't know the answer to that, and I can find it out.
Thank you. Representative Moline.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I mean, just piggybacking off of Representative Lesh's questions and the answers, I guess I have real concerns that people who have the right to use firearms restored's names are being transferred at all to NICS. You know, their names should no longer be in NICS if it's only for the purpose of background checks for firearms, and that person has the right to use firearms restored, there's really no reason for their name to be in that system. So if we're doing that now since 2010, which it sounds like we don't know if we are, that concerns me. But if we're going to go back to 1994 and potentially be doing that to hundreds of Minnesotans who have potentially had their rights restored, I think that's really worrisome to me.
Representative Cornish.
It's my understanding that NICS was established solely for the reason of the check. So it would make only common sense that if you had somebody who's civilly and mentally committed, that you would send them to NICS. And as far as getting their rights restored, once they go through the records,
and find somebody that's civilly committed that's had their right restored, they aren't going to send them to NICS. I mean, the only thing you'd send to NICS would be the ones that were still in effect is committed, I would think.
She said that they would.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, if once they've been civilly. Go ahead.
Who wants the question? Miss... Who wants it?
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, then I must have misunderstood what Representative Lush was asking me. If their civil rights have been restored, then there is no reason to send them to NICS.
Okay.
And he was asking about redacting.
Right.
And we wouldn't redact.
And I also
Representative Cornish.
I think there is a system in the NICS system itself when you get rejected and you say, hey, something's wrong, at least there has been for the few that I've checked out, or there's a number that you dial and there's a process to get you out of the system once you mistakenly put into it. I've done that a few times, so I don't really see the problem. I think it was originated for the purpose of putting these things in. They aren't going to send anybody that isn't committed. And once you are, and wrongfully, I think there's a process to get them out, on my understanding.
All right. So you'll gather information for the next time that we meet. You'll try to get some clarification to the questions from members. Any other questions from members on these pieces? All right, Senator Latz, anything else on this proposal?
No.
All right, Senator Latz, you have an additional proposal that's new to the list. Do you have some language on a forensic lab accreditation?
Yes, I do.
If you could hand that out to the committee members so we can take a look at it, and please enlighten us as to the Senate's position.
Chair John, I'll appreciate it.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair and members, the language that is being passed out before you would mandate that forensic laboratories in Minnesota that are performing certain kinds of analysis for use as evidence in court be accredited. There's a definition in here of the forensic, what forensic analysis means and what forensic laboratory means, and there are two levels of accreditation that are proposed here. One level of accreditation is under the International Organization for Standardization, or ISO 17025, which is the higher level of accreditation that would apply to labs that are doing basically DNA analysis, fluid analysis, firearms analysis, and so on. They can also do a broader range of work that is covered by some of the lower levels of accreditation also. The second level of accreditation that is permitted in this proposal is under ISO 17020, which would cover labs that are doing latent fingerprint identification in addition to crime scene processing, but not the other stuff that's covered by 17025. The purpose of the accreditation mandate is to provide for reliability of evidence that is used in court in the effort of the state to prove that a particular criminal defendant is guilty of the crime, and therefore to seek sentencing, including lengthy prison sentences, and also to increase the public confidence in the justice system, confidence that those who are charged with crimes and, more importantly, ultimately convicted of crimes were done so with properly analyzed evidence, and also that those for whom there has been evidence that was analyzed that did not support criminal charges either never face criminal charges, or when the results of the lab testing comes back, if they've already been charged, can have charges modified or dropped altogether. There have been occasions when analyses of evidence were done in which there were controlled substances, for example, found or reported to be in, say, blood, when in fact they were not. And there have been occasions resulting in false charges and potentially even false convictions and imprisonment. And on the other side, there have been occasions in which there have been analyses done where there was not any controlled substances found in a fluid, when in fact it was there. And then someone who had violated the law would have inappropriately escaped criminal consequences for their conduct. So this was the formulation that you have before you was compiled in consultation and through the Senate Judiciary Committee process, but in consultation with the Minnesota BCA laboratory, with the St. Paul crime laboratory, with the former chairman of the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board for the state of Minnesota, with the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office lab director, verifying information about the status of the Minneapolis crime lab as well. It is supported by the Ramsey County attorney, John Choi, the Dakota County attorney, Jim Backstrom, the Hennepin County Sheriff, Stanek, and I have an email from the St. Paul crime lab in which their concerns have been addressed, according to their email from Assistant Chief Wernan. And I will note in particular they raised two concerns. One had to do with the ability to credit under the ISO 17020 standard rather than the 17025 standard. And so you'll see on lines 31 to 33 of the proposal before you that permission is included for that to occur. And then their second concern was that there was no mechanism for startup labs to achieve accreditation. And there was language also that was included in this proposal that provides for that to occur. As long as either a startup lab or a lab that does not yet have accreditation documents that they have completed the formal the process for, they're beginning the process of formally seeking accreditation, and they provide documentation every 6 months to that effect, and they are operating consistently with the standards that would lead toward that accreditation. There would be a deadline by which labs would need to be accredited, and that in this proposal is July 1, 2015, unless they have unless they've been operating for less than 3 years, and then they have a three-year window from when they began operating the lab. The proof of accreditation or the being in the process of seeking accreditation is to be reported to the Commissioner of Public Safety and posted on the department's website, so the information is publicly known. I hasten to add that this would not by itself create, at least not by its terms, create any presumptions of admissibility or insulate any labs from the judicial or legal process in a criminal proceeding in which, of course, the proponent of evidence still has a burden of proving that it's admissible and that it's reliable, and the opponent of the evidence would have the ability to question and challenge the admissibility and reliability of that evidence. So with that stated, I'd be happy to answer questions. I'd ask for the committee to support it.
Senator Latz, I have a question. So once the state adopts a policy, or a law that says that all labs must be accredited, what happens in the current cases where things have been going through these labs that have not yet been accredited because now the state would be taking on a policy or a statute saying that labs must be accredited? Senator Latz.
I'm not quite sure I understand your question about stuff that's going through the current labs.
Senator Latz, my question really relates to, current testing that's already been completed, potentially criminal or civil cases that are already going through the process, whereby I assume that not all labs in Minnesota are currently accredited. That's the purpose of the bill. So once the state adopts a statute about this accreditation requirement, does that have an influence on those current pending cases and the credibility of the evidence of those currently tested materials or current pending cases? Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I think the answer would be up to each individual judge that was confronted with the question of whether or not to admit the proffered evidence. There's nothing in the proposed statute here that would make a final determination about reliability or credibility or admissibility of the evidence. I would anticipate that as part of the state's case, that when they are offering evidence, they would as a foundation for it, they would offer documentation or proof that the evidence was analyzed or obtained through an accredited lab. And that if a lab had not been accredited yet when that evidence was produced, that the defense would have the opportunity to point out that the lab hadn't gone through the accreditation process at that point or was in the middle of it but hadn't yet achieved accreditation.
Representative Lesh, did you have a question or a comment?
Sure. Senator Latz, your proposal calls for this to become effective July 1st of 2015. Why the rush to get this through this session?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, first I'm going to say I've been asked, Senate leadership has asked us to go check in on the Senate floor because they're in session. So I'll answer the question if I may, and then I'll have to depart for a moment. Representative Lesh, it is not an instant process to become accredited. You have to, even once you start the formal process of seeking accreditation, you have to be observed on a periodic basis by the accrediting agencies, and those are, by the way, also spelled out in the proposal here. Then you'd have to get all your processes in place and be running the lab, essentially. And what I'm informed that it can take anywhere from 6 months to several years to achieve accreditation, depending upon what level of accreditation you're seeking and the resources that you're willing to put in to achieve that accreditation. A later start to this mandate would result in a later point of accreditation for the labs that would be subject to the mandate.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Latz, it's my understanding that this process has already started for the St. Paul Crime Lab, for example, and it was based upon what had occurred almost a year ago now with the forensic work done by Christine Funk and Lori Traub. So I'm not sure that insisting that this be passed this year is going to make any difference for the labs that this would affect. Let me ask this also. Do you have, you outsource, Senator Latz, the standards designation in this bill to an international standards organization? And normally, of course, this would be an agency job of Minnesota government to decide what kinds of standards are in place for state government. In this case, the agency is not an agency, but it's the courts that admit the evidence. So you say you have multiple organizations that would set these standards. Is there anyone who can speak to this? You said you had someone from the chairman, former chairman of the Forensic Lab Advisory Board. Do you have anyone from the named organization in the bill, American Society of Crime Laboratory Directors, who could answer questions about this?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, the language and the process for developing the accreditation was originally brought to me by the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board members, even though formally the board no longer exists, including Brian Kasbaum. They recommended that most of the labs, in fact, the labs in Minnesota that are accredited already, the Hennepin County Lab, the BCA Lab, the Minneapolis Lab, the BCA Bemidji Lab. They are ASCLAD lab accredited. So the first organization that you have in there in line 26. In the course of, so they're the ones that proposed that. This organization and the two others that are identified there, the American Association for Laboratory Accreditation and the Forensic Quality Services, they are themselves accredited by the International Laboratory Accreditation Cooperation, ILAC, as having their processes in place so that they can go out and accredit the actual forensic laboratories. So there's kind of a double layer here of reliability that is found in this proposal. So the St. Paul Lab, for example, is seeking their accreditation to the standard of ISO 17020 through the accreditation organization Forensic Quality Services, FQS.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And
Representative Latz.
Senator Latz, normally it would be the legislature who would say what goes and what doesn't go with respect to agency determinations. And in this case, you have these organizations. I don't think anyone on the committee is familiar with them, aside from you who's been researching them. So I think there is some cause to say, to ask questions of these people. Who checks the checkers? Who accredits the accreditors? The International Organization for Standardization. Is there anyone available from that organization to testify as to how they make these determinations?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, I'm not aware of any situation where the legislature actually goes into such intimate detail as to prescribe the laboratory analysis processes in state statute. That's something that, you know, I don't even think that process is mandated for the BCA. And I think we have, I saw Frank Dolish over around here earlier from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. So the ISO standards, I think probably everyone is familiar generally with the international standardization organization process, and they're used commonly for businesses as well as all sorts of other standardization levels, and are highly reliable. I can tell you that there the other labs in Minnesota that have the ASCLAD lab accreditation, Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, Minneapolis Police Department, BCA Lab St. Paul, BCA Bemidji, and the Target Forensic Laboratory, and they are doing everything from latent fingerprint identification, firearms, DNA analysis, full service, controlled substances, blood alcohol, and digital forensics. That appears to be a standard which is generally accepted. In my consultation with Frank Dolish from the BCA and Brian Kasbaum from the Forensic Lab Advisory Board, they identified the other two organizations, as well as received the information directly from the St. Paul Lab or Police Department, that Forensic Quality Services is also an established and widely accepted accrediting organization. And we were contacted by the American Association for Laboratory Accreditation, which also has the ILAC accreditation for being able to accredit labs. And I verified that also with Frank Dolish from the BCA and with Brian Kasbaum from the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board. By the way, while I'm thinking of it, I neglected to mention that the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police Association, are also formally in support of mandating the accreditation. I have an email from them, and they both testified at other proceedings to that position.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Senator Latz, everybody does this stuff. Isn't always the gold standard by which we pass language into law around here. Sometimes it may be, but when you have all these organizations specifically named in a bill to which this policymaking body would outsource standards, I want to know more about them, who they are. American Society of Crime Laboratory Directors, Laboratory Accreditation Board, International Organization for Standardization, International Laboratory Accreditation Cooperative, Forensic Quality Services. All of these organizations are named into statute, which has happened from time to time, but normally we set the objective standards here rather than outsourcing them to a separate body or agency. If that state government were to do that, it would normally be agency rulemaking action that would do that. So I do have questions about that I would like people here from those organizations to be able to answer if we are going to memorialize this into statute. Second, the bifurcated nature of the 17025 and 17020 accreditation levels. Why did you do that? Which other states do that? And how did other states come to conclusion based upon their experience that that was the appropriate way to go?
Senator Latz, then Senator Cornish.
Madam Chair, to Senator Representative Lesch's first question, number one, Frank, is Frank Dolish in the room by any chance? I can't see everyone. He's coming. Okay. He's certainly the state's expert on crime labs, and he could testify as to the recognition of ASCLAD Lab and the other organizations. But I will note, I've got an email here from Assistant St. Paul Police Chief Kathy Wernan, in which she describes the ASCLAD Lab and FQS are considered the premier accrediting bodies recognized by the international scientific community. The ASCLAD Lab, it's an acronym for American Society of Crime Laboratory Directors Laboratory Accreditation Board. According to the Assistant Chief, and I know she's done research on this, as they were determining what process and through what organization to seek accreditation, that's what she states in her email. I will tell you candidly, the BCA director and the FLAB person, Mr. Kasbaum, both strongly preferred that the mandatory accreditation be only at the higher level of accreditation, 17025. But that the St. Paul Crime Lab indicated to me that they were specifically seeking accreditation under the second tier of standards. Although it was not the preference to set up a two-tier accreditation system in Minnesota, I thought it appropriate to accommodate their desire to seek an accreditation for the scope of services that they intended to provide, which is a latent fingerprint identification as well as some of the crime scene collection stuff. The other processing, which would be more appropriate under a 17025 accreditation standard, are being outsourced, to use Representative Lesch's term, to the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Lab.
Well, Madam
Representative
Chair
Lesch.
And Senator Latz, I appreciate you talking with individuals since you introduced the bill on deadline week in March and coming to a resolution with them about the two-tier bifurcated system of standardization in Minnesota. I'm willing to bet that the Judiciary Public Safety Committees in the Minnesota House would have liked the same opportunity to have those conversations, determine whether or not that was an appropriate resolution on this bill. Senator Latz, have you considered whether or not this proposal unreasonably or unconstitutionally invades the judicial branch and their determination as to the admissibility of evidence in their courts?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, first of all, I was intentionally not going into the procedural history of this legislation, Representative Lesch, but so that the public record is clear, I introduced the bill in the Senate 2 weeks before deadline and sent the jackets over to yourself. And they apparently sat in your office or on your desk unattended to the point I had to get duplicate jackets and get someone else to introduce them on the deadline week. It was introduced before the deadline passed.
And you declined to hear the bill in your committee and declined to have informational hearings, despite my several requests to do so. And in fact, I had great difficulty even obtaining a response from your office. So I did not want to go there, Representative Lesch, but I want the record to be clear on that. As to the constitutional questions, I am not aware. No one has raised any questions to me about the constitutionality of the state mandating that evidence produced by publicly funded laboratories be done so in a laboratory that is accredited. As I indicated at the beginning of this presentation, there is nothing in here that mandates that a court of law accept evidence, find it admissible, find the foundation sufficiently proven, or anything like that. And there's nothing that creates any legal presumptions, although the legislature has frequently interposed itself in judicial proceedings dealing with admissibility of evidence and the lack of necessity for certain laboratory analysts even testify in proceedings unless requested. I'm thinking specifically with regard to blood and urine alcohol results in implied consent proceedings. We have mandatory sentences all over the place, which are arguably unconstitutional because of the separation of powers. But there's nothing in this bill that directs the courts to do anything with anything. It only applies to publicly funded labs and the standards of reliability that they are to produce evidence at has to be achieved as much as possible through internationally recognized accreditation process.
So, Senator, or Representative Lesch, we're going to let you ask another question. Representative Cornish has one as well. I just want members to know Senator Dibble has something he wants us to talk about, and we need to take a break at 12:30 to come back. So, Representative Lesch.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a laundry list of other questions. I'm not sure which could be satisfactorily answered today. But in response to Senator Latz's comments, Senator, I'm sorry if I upset you or made you sore by not taking up this bill on deadline week. These are serious questions that I have. Deadline week was really busy. I did not do that to snub you. I want these questions answered, and especially me being the a representative from St. Paul, and this being brought on by incidents at the St. Paul Crime Lab, I think I'm in a position to have to ask these questions, and there are a lot of questions I have. When you introduced this in Data Practices Committee, you reeled off a whole series of things that you did, research that you did, to determine whether or not you thought this stuff was appropriate. And I was impressed that you had done all that work that I didn't know about. I want to know about that, too, and I want members of the House to know about that, especially me being from St. Paul. So, Madam Chair, I will delay my other questions for now, and we can come back to them, but I just wanted to leave it at that.
Thanks. Representative Cornish.
Well, Madam Chair, it's more of a comment. Senator Latz, you've asked us for a couple of pretty big things here, so this would be my suggestion when you go back and when we caucus and others that you think about some of the things that you've kind of entrenched yourself in and are digging in a little bit, and then maybe we could accomplish something.
Is Senator Dibble coming back?
I think he gave, Chairman Hillstrom, he gave the language to Representative Paymer because he had to call in for a phone interview.
So, Representative Paymer, are you aware of what Senator Dibble wanted us to hear about prior to us breaking us? Representative Paymer.
Madam Chair, members, this came out of the issue of us using the DVS special revenue account money to fund the data systems at the Department of Public, BCA. And so this was some language to make using that fund more difficult and more transparent, I guess. So I asked Mr. Diebel to come up. Did you do this or Becky do it? Mr. Diebel to come up with some language. Maybe you can explain what you... I have a copy of it if you want. Let me just first say that Senator Diebel wanted some language that said something like prohibited expenditures. The commissioner is prohibited from expending money from the driver and vehicle services accounts created in the special revenue fund for any purpose that is not specifically authorized in this section or in the chapter specified in this section. And then to include the language that Mr. Diebel drafted. So this would be, I suppose, after the fact, obviously, but if you could just explain the language that you came up with.
Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar members, the proposed language would require the Commissioner of Public Safety to submit a report when the fund in question reaches a certain threshold of surplus. The idea being that the report would provide the legislature with the notice of the excessive surplus in the account and provide recommendations to the legislature, both policy and legislative recommendations as to how to avoid the surplus reaching that level again and resolving the surplus at that point. And this, again, would be after the fact that it reaches this point, but it would give the legislature notice that the account had accrued a certain level. And it sets up a basic equation to trigger the reporting requirement, and the report would be due within 3 months of that threshold being met.
Representative Paymar.
I don't know if Ms. Ellison wants to respond to this, but...
Ms. Ellison.
Commissioner
Ellison, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. We would be fine with that language. I mean, as I explained previously, the way it works now is that we can't spend the money unless we have specific appropriations authority from the legislature. If this language, though, is important, we would certainly not oppose it.
Representative Paymar. Yes? All right. Any other questions from members?
Madam Chair, we'll get this drafted and then as a...
Thank you, Representative Paymar. And then we'll distribute the language. Are there any other issues, Senator Latz, related to the offer that you're making for the House to consider when we break here to come back with a new offer? Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I don't think there's anything else to put on the table except that I should note that Jared Jordahl was here from the and the Commissioner of Public Safety was here as well, and they have represented in the past that the governor supports the crime lab accreditation mandate as well. I thought I'd just put that on the record. If the commissioner wants to state it any more formally, it's fine. But.
Welcome to the committee. If you want to make a few comments, we're going to break here. I can't quite see the clock based on the reflection, but I think in about 5 minutes. So state your name for the record and go ahead, Commissioner.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. Mona Dolman, Commissioner of Public Safety, for the record. And Senator Latz, that is correct. I've had discussions with the governor and governor's staff on lab accreditation, and he is in support of labs operating within the state of Minnesota being accredited.
Questions from members? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Doman, do you have a list of all the labs, publicly funded labs in the state, that would have to be accredited under this proposed language?
Commissioner Doman.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh. There are varying levels of, let me first state that there are, I believe, 17 different entities within the state that operate some sort of crime scene processing and or lab analysis work. And some of the 17 actually consider themselves a lab, but they're not necessarily a lab. They might collect fingerprints at a scene to then send those fingerprints on maybe to the BCA or another lab for analysis. So that's the first part of the answer to the question. The second part is I think Senator Latz has named the agencies. Our two labs, Hennepin County, the Tri-County Lab, which is Stearns, Sherburn, Anoka. Is that right?
Wright County,
Anoka County, and Sherburn County, I'm sorry, is the Tri-County Lab. And then the Target Lab, which is private. I believe that those are the only labs that would be ASCLAD or the other accredited lab.
Okay.
Representative Lesch.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Doman, why is your conclusion that these are the only labs that would qualify under the definition of this proposal?
Commissioner Doman.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, I'm going to have the Superintendent Wade Setter come to answer that question. He has had these discussions with Frank Dolish, our lab director.
Superintendent Setter. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Wade Setter. I'm the superintendent of the BCA. When some of the challenges appeared a year ago with regard to the accreditation discussion, our lab just did a survey and determined, I think, about 17 agencies in the state of Minnesota do some degree of forensic, either collection of evidence or examination. The labs that have been testified to that are ASCLAD accredited right now, I know the Tri-County Lab, which is Anoka, Sherburn, Wright, is working on and expects to be ASCLAD accredited by early next year, 2014, is at least their plan. So most of them do fingerprint examinations. The only ones we're aware of that do drug chemistry were St. Paul, of course, until they discontinued last July. Ourselves, our Bemidji lab does that, and Hennepin County does not do that, nor does Minneapolis. And here is Frank Dolish, our lab director, just hot off the parking lot. So, all
right. Okay, thank you.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Superintendent Setter. You all pick who the best person is to answer the question.
It would be Frank Dolish, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Representative Lesch, do you want to re-ask your question based on the fact that he just got in the room?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Dolish. It's been testified to that there are 17 entities of the state that would be obligated under the language as proposed here. Do you have a list of what those entities are and where those labs are?
Mr. Dolish.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, I'm Frank Dolish, the lab director for the BCA Laboratory. I believe that I just provided the list to the. Did you give it to the committee?
If I can find a way to print it, I have.
Please state your name for the
I'm
record,
sorry.
Just so that for the tape.
Sorry, I'm Jared Jordahl, Government Relations for the Department of Public Safety. I have it in electronic form, and I will try to find a printer and successfully get it printed off my iPhone. But I did. It was emailed by the lab director, Mr. Dolish, to me today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesch.
Mr. Dolish, how did you come to the conclusion, and I'll wait to see this list so maybe we can follow up on it later, but how did you come to the conclusion that it is only these entities that would be affected by the proposed language?
Mr. Dolish.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, this was a survey that the Forensic Lab Advisory Board did late last year. They actually reached out to the various police and sheriff's department in an attempt to try to determine what various departments were doing and whether they had any units that would qualify as forensic laboratories. I can't promise you that it's complete because we didn't get responses from some people, but it was the best that we could put together under the circumstances.
Well, thank you,
Representative Lesch.
Madam Chair and Mr. Dolish, and this is nothing on you, but yeah, we do expect a list like that to be complete when we're passing law and a statute up here. Sometimes it's difficult, but we need to have that. Let me ask, was the Mr. Dolish, was the ag lab or the health lab, both of which I think we have in the state, were either of those on your list?
Mr. Dolish.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, they were not, and I don't think that that the type of work that they do would qualify. Maybe I'm mistaken, but
well, so Madam Chair, Mr. Dolish, you're the expert.
Representative Lesh, please go through the chair.
Madam Chair.
We just have a few minutes left here, Representative Lesh, so make sure you ask really great questions in these last few minutes.
I think all these questions are great, Madam Chair. So based, Ms. Dolish, and this, your province is forensics and laboratory, but under the bill, which is kind of our area up here, it states the forensic laboratory means a publicly financed laboratory within the state that conducts forensic analysis. Now, forensic analysis means legal analysis or analysis which could lead to a legal conclusion that is not limited to criminal. And the definition further states of items of evidence that are part of or have the potential to be used in a criminal investigation. So if the ag lab or the health lab, both of whom I assume are probably accredited in their respective bodies, but nonetheless, has evidence that it is analyzing that could lead to a legal conclusion, whether that be a civil legal conclusion or a criminal, and ultimately it could be used or have the potential to be used in a criminal investigation, it falls under the gambit of this bill, which is kind of one of the questions I have and why I would like to hear from the directors of those labs before we would do anything on this. So that's not so much a question but more of a statement, Madam Chair. Now, I can certainly save my other questions for later on if we're limited on time. What's your choice, Madam Chair?
So, Representative Lesh, we're going to break, and we're going to make an offer, and I assume that as part of the offer you're going to raise that you have some concerns with this piece, right? So we're going to have a conversation about that, and we'll come back, and I assume that folks will be available to ask questions if we have questions in the interim.
Chair, may I ask a quick question, Mr. Dolish, before we break?
Senator Latz will let you clarify if there's anything you need to clarify here and then clarify anything on the offer, and then we're going to break. Okay. Senator Latz.
Just while we have Mr. Dolish here, I just want to clarify. The bill identifies three bodies that would be permitted under this statute to accredit labs, and then has a catch-all phrase that says other accrediting body that's been evaluated by ILAC and found to meet the accreditation standards under 17011. But I just want to clarify from you for the record here, the ASCLAD lab, the American Association for Laboratory Accreditation, and the Forensic Quality Services, are they nationally or internationally recognized lab accreditation bodies that are reliable, if you will?
Mr. Dolish.
Madam Chair, Senator, these are the three accrediting bodies that are currently accrediting forensic laboratories. Yes.
Senator Latz, is there anything else that you'd like to say in relationship to the offer that's on the table so we can go back and consider it?
No, Madam Chair.
All right. Anything else? With that, this meeting is in recess to the call of the chair.